The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. With a background in history and academia, Dr. Nicholas Morgan joined United Distillers, which is now Diageo, in 1990. There, he created what is now considered the world's most comprehensive spirits archive, before making a somewhat unlikely transition to leader of Diageo's global malt whisky marketing team. Nicholas retired from Diageo in December 2020, following the publication of his acclaimed book, A Long Stride, the story of the world's number one Scotch whisky, written as part of the bicentennial celebrations of John Walker and Sons. His latest book is Everything You Wanted to Know About Whisky But Were Too Afraid to Ask. It's a great read, and we discuss both it and the Johnny Walker book later on in this interview with Nicholas, who is a master of the quake. That's one of the highest honours in Scotch whisky and a member of the Whisky Magazine Hall of Fame. But I started by asking Nicholas about the challenges he faced marketing single malt whisky at Diageo when he took on that role in the 1990s.
From a business point of view, actually, when we started in 1997-98, no one was really interested in single malts at a very senior level in the business. They couldn't understand quite why you'd be fussed around selling 30,000 cases of Talisker or 40,000 cases of Lagavulin, which, in fact, maybe we were selling less than that at the time. Why would you be interested in that when you could sell, you know, hundreds of thousands of cases, millions of cases of J&B or Johnny Walker or whatever it might be? So malts were very much under the radar. There was no real investment. But actually, that was great because it meant with a very small team, we could just plug away and no one really paid much attention to what we were doing. And actually, Talisker went from around 20 or 30,000 cases to about 90 or 100,000 cases. Lagavulin, actually, we reached the top of Lagavulin because it's a small distillery and it's still in the same position. We just can't make enough Lagavulin. And we had Cardhu single malt brand, which was absolutely on fire in Spain, selling hundreds of thousands of cases. So in about the 10 years, we had a 10-year period where no one was paying much attention. And suddenly they all went, holy shit, there's money to be made here. You know, and we'd also persuaded people to give us access to these whiskies that they didn't really know what to do with. So we had, not a lot, but we had some old Port Ellen, mainly from the late 1970s and early 1980s. We had old Brora, we had old Glenury Royal.
Who's going to want to drink those?
Well, exactly. And the other thing is, who's going to want to pay almost £100 a bottle for that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But we started doing all of that stuff as well. And, you know, not only suddenly were very much internally above the horizon because people could see what the real business opportunity was, but I think certainly with those, what we call the special releases, we sort of shifted the paradigm, I think, into, and not necessarily for the better, but we shifted the paradigm in terms of these special limited bottlings, pricing, and of course the secondary market, which just exploded, you know, in the early sort of 2025, 2010, around there.
How do you think your background in history kind of shaped your approach to marketing? Because that seems like quite a different background to what most marketers would have.
Yeah, well, I suppose, well, there's a couple of things. I mean, history is a, as you may know, James, it's a, you can study medieval history, you can study early modern history, you can study contemporary modern history, and people can get bogged down in those specialisms. But really, history is a way of thinking. It's a way of approaching problems and solving problems. It's a way of finding perhaps unusual sources of evidence and material that will help you in problem solving and generating new ideas. So I've always viewed history as a sort of intellectual discipline that's free of whatever particular, you know, little subject it might be in history that you're looking at. And I think when you apply that sort of thinking, along with a bit healthy bit of skepticism, which is also very much part of what the historian's toolkit should have in it, and just some intuition. And I think the thing about single malts is that when we started doing it, it was very intuitive. You know, it wasn't hard to see with brands like Talisker that it was just all about this astonishing place where this astonishing whiskey came from. You know, you taste Talisker, you're there, you're in the Kulin Mountains, you know, you're down by the shores of Loch Harport, by the distillery at Carbost. So, you know, we had a very simple way of looking at it. And I think it's a phrase I put in the book because it's a really good one. You know, malt whiskey is all about places, people, and products. You mix that together and you will come up with something that's really compelling for consumers, you know.
What do you make of how single malt whiskey is typically marketed today? Because obviously it's a very different market, very competitive, and marketers probably have to be a little bit more creative than what you've said in order to stand out, or maybe they think they do anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, I think, that, you know, many brands seem to have taken the route that the way to capture a consumer's heart, maybe it's actually retailers that they're thinking about, but possibly consumer's heart, you know, is just to have a multiplicity of releases. Sometimes, frankly, not always of a great standard. I think, you know, the guys that do all the blogging and stuff like that will do every new release is great. Everything's fantastic. They're all wonderful. You know, what could be better than this latest unaged whiskey that's been finished in some weird combination of casks, frankly, just to try and make it taste half decent because it's too young to bottle otherwise, which is what a lot of them are. And so there's so much of that going on that I think attention is diverted from the core strength of all single malts, which is that standard bottling, like Talisker 10-year-old. It's 10 years old. It's one of the best whiskies in the world. You know, it is one of the best whiskies in the world. And if you look at people who I respect very much, like Serge Valentin on the Whiskey Fun website, you know, who's this great reviewer of whiskies, probably one of the best palates and noses in the world of whiskey. And he was looking at Talisker 10-year-old just a few months ago, I think, and gave it 92 points or something like that, you know. And the 92 points is what you might normally think a 40-year-old Glenlivet would get or something like that. But no, Talisker 10, 92 points. You know, these whiskies are great. And I do think that brand owners should actually spend more time nurturing and cherishing their core brands and perhaps a little less time filling the shelves of retailers with some of this stuff that's really not particularly great.
What was it about the Johnnie Walker story that compelled you to want to write a book about it? Because it sounds like that was very much at your urging that happened.
Yeah, well, actually, I'd been angling for that job for a long time. And in Diageo, like most other big companies, you know, there's a very disciplined and rigorous sort of review process each year. And how have you done? You know, what would you like to do? All that sort of stuff. And for about 10 years or more, I think, I'd simply been writing in the box that said ambition. I would like to write the Johnnie Walker history for the bicentenary. And I've been talking to people about it. You know, I'm not a pushy guy, but I just made it known that this was really what I wanted to do. And in the end, a man called David Gates, who at the time was in charge of all sort of whiskies in Diageo, said, go on, you should do this. And that was 2017, which was arguably a year too late, I think, in terms of the research. I mean, if you look at the book, or those people who have read it will know that it's pretty packed with information, but it would have been better, I think, if I'd had another year or so to look at some more stuff. Why did I want to do that? Well, it's just such an astonishing company. It's an astonishing brand. And the archive, although it was by no means complete, was the Jewers archive, which Diageo had and then parted, or United Distillers had and parted company with when Jewers was sold to Bacardi. Jewers archive was very good as well, but I think the Walker archive was the best. And there was also not just business records, but there was quite a lot of sort of semi-personal information there, which allowed you to get under the skin of the personalities. So it's not just a sort of dry as dust business history, it's about people. And the Walkers and the people that worked in that business were quite remarkable people. I mean, it's a remarkable brand, and remarkable people make remarkable brands. And that's really what the story is about, as much as it's about figures and cases that they sold and all of that stuff, you know.
Had that story, you know, gotten a bit lost over time in a company like Diageo?
It hadn't got lost. I mean, people in Diageo are rightly very proud of Johnnie Walker, and the company's always, I think, done a great job at trying to get all of its employees, no matter what they do in the business, to understand its brands and to take pride in them, and to take a sense of stewardship in them, which is, I think, that's what responsible brand owners should do, right? But I think the story had been abbreviated, partly actually by the last Walker to be involved in the company was Sir Alexander Walker, who was chairman up until just about the start of the Second World War. And he sort of rewrote the history as you know, last man in writes the history. So he sort of left some things behind that became the story of the company. It's a nice story. It's all about a few heroic members of the family, most notably Sir Alexander Walker. But there was a lot more to the story than that, and a lot of richness and colour. And also a lot that's really to do not just with Johnnie Walker, but with the whole growth of the Scotch whisky category in the 19th and 20th century. So it wasn't forgotten. It had just been a bit abbreviated. So it was like a sort of skeleton that everyone loved, but was in the cupboard for the most part. So I got the skeleton out and put the flesh back on it and made it into a real living thing. You know, that's what I tried to do anyway.
Were there any particular revelations that came out in your research that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I think the thing that is quite central to the sort of middle part of the book, which is where all the real meat is, was first of all the role of John Walker's son, Alexander Walker, who inherited a grocery shop from his father in 1857. And just about 30 years later, when he died, left his sons an international whiskey business. Astonishing growth over a very short period, a very driven man whose letterbooks from the later part of his life survive. So he's a big character. This isn't I suppose it's a revelation when you really get inside the head of someone who's trying to cope with business growth on that scale. So that the Alexander Walker thing, I hadn't realized how important that was and how intense a character he was. The other thing I think was the development of the Johnnie Walker brand, which we all think now it's that man, you know, the guy in the top hat and everything walking all over the world. Well, he didn't appear until 1908. And before that, Walker's whiskey was actually, in a sense, quite poorly branded because it was sometimes called Walker's Kilmarnock whiskey, sometimes called Square Bottle whiskey, John Walker and Sons. And this idea of Johnnie Walker was actually created by consumers. So in the 1880s and 1890s, in popular culture, in Scotland, in England, people are talking about Johnnie Walker, this whiskey, as if it's a person. The company hated that because they thought it was disrespectful to the founder, John Walker. Okay? They absolutely hated it. And John Walker's wife lived until she was very old when she died, and she had quite an influence over the family. So you can imagine the stern old grandmother by that point, you know, saying, "We're not having this Johnnie Walker business." And it took a man from outside the family, but another Kilmarnock man who'd worked in the business since he was a teenager, called James Stevenson, to actually make Johnnie Walker happen. And he was assisted by an American advertising agent called Paul E. Derrick. And between the two of them, in 1907, 1908, they created this figure. And they pushed the Walker brand onto the advertising stage, which had previously really been owned, more or less, by Dewars and Buchanans, Walkers had just hadn't done much of that stuff. They just believed if they made the best whiskey, they would sell the most, which is a great sort of sense to have, but increasingly was not going to win the war, as it were. But as soon as the Johnny Walker figure was created, it just blew away the competition. It sort of rewrote the whole semiotics of whiskey advertising and actually of all advertising. If you look at the advertising literature at the time, of which there was a lot, this person that suddenly appeared out of nowhere, and you have to think of it on huge posters. This isn't, I mean, it's in print advertising as well, but this is really poster advertising when people go to work on the tram, on the train, on coaches, or they're walking to work, and everywhere you've got this huge figure that somehow come from nowhere, and yet everyone knows it's Johnny Walker because they've been talking about him for 20 or 30 years, and suddenly there he is, you know, everywhere, absolutely everywhere. So that story is really important, and I think it is a revelation, and it's a story that's actually much bigger than just Johnny Walker, because it's about branding and advertising and creative thinking, and about marketing, because the way they did that, marketers today would understand every move they made and all the thinking and briefing that went into it as well.
Moving on to your next book, Everything You Need to Know About Whiskey, But Are Too Afraid to Ask. There's such an extensive canon of whiskey literature out there. What was your first reaction when it was suggested that you should contribute something to it?
Well, I was asked to go and meet Sukhinder Singh at the Whiskey Exchange in London, and I know Sukhinder very well. I've known him for many years. And he explained that he had this idea for a whiskey book. He'd been approached by a publisher who were very keen to make the book happen, that he wanted a book that would be different from the books that were out there. He wanted a book that would, I think, be both appealing and approachable to people who really didn't know much about whiskey, but also interesting and entertaining to people who did know a lot about whiskey. So that was quite a difficult thing. And also, you know, he wanted a book, I think, that would have some opinions in it and some point of view on a few things as well. You know, something that would provoke discussion and provoke debate. And, you know, what he described and then what I discussed with the publishers was really the book that I'd always wanted to write in many respects. And I was able to sort of come up with a brief description of what the book might be, which I think is actually what's now written on the back cover. That was the first thing I wrote, just a short paragraph, which everyone seemed to like. And I got very excited by it. And Sukhinder was excited, publishers were excited. And then I just had to sit down in our third lockdown in the UK and write the thing. And of course, because we were in lockdown, although that I still needed to get some material, I mean, I had to do a bit of research or using online sources, but actually it was very cathartic because I couldn't make that excuse that writers like to do, which is, oh, I just need to go to the British Library this week and do a bit more research. You know, no British Library to go to, so I just had to sit and write the thing. And I think in a sense that helped in terms of how the books come out, because I was writing quickly and fast. And I was listening to myself writing, because I do a lot of talking interviews like this. So I was trying to write it as if I were talking to people quite often. So to try and make it quite conversational. And also it allowed me to get the sort of more, what you might call controversial bits into it quite easily. I had to pull back on some of those. Well, that's fine, because I think the book's now well-balanced and it might surprise some people, but hopefully it won't offend or upset anyone too much.
It seems like you had some myths you wanted to bust. One of the quotes that I sort of sat back in my seat a little bit when I read it was, terroir is less of a grand concept and more of a cash cow.
Yeah, I was very pleased with that one, actually. Yeah, well, I mean, I think there seems to be amongst some people who are very invested and sort of engaged with single malt whiskey that the Diageos and the Pernod Ricos and all of that stuff, Pernod Ricard, are the sort of bad guys. marketing, cynical PR, all the rest of it. And then all the new guys that have come along to the scene and talk about sustainability and terroir and, you know, blah, 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 are somehow doing it all from the heart, you know? So these people that are trying to get you to buy three-year-old whiskey in 50 CL bottles for 70 or 80 pounds, bearing in mind the bottle of Talisker, I'm going to keep on coming back to Talisker, a bottle of Talisker 10-year-old would cost you about 40 pounds or less. But somehow these guys are doing it out of the kindness of their heart. You know, we should feel thrilled to be able to buy these products. But the fact of the matter is, of course, that the business model for people with new distilleries means that they have to sell whiskey. It's not like the old days where you could sell what we call fillings. So that's all the casks that you fill. You'd sell them all to Johnny Walker or you'd sell them all to Dewars. And that's how you made your money, just by selling these fillings. These guys with these new distilleries are sitting on all of this stuff. And although they may be fronted by guys that seem to be really funky and everything, behind them are investors, right? And what do investors want? They want money. They want return on their investment. So it's a business imperative for these people to find new ways, new things to talk to people about to help them sell this very young whiskey. And as far as I'm concerned, terroir, which I'm known to be quite cynical about, you know, it's not the first time I've said this sort of thing publicly. Terroir, which I think is totally misapplied to whiskey. I don't understand why people want to take all these wine terms and apply them quite incorrectly to Scotch or to any other sort of whiskies. But terroir is one of those things that you can say, look, it's all about terroir. And you know, I know actually full well that if there is any influence, for example, on barley varieties and all that sort of things that people like to talk about, it disappears. As the whiskey ages, it disappears. So if you want to get a hit of something that may be terroir, who knows, you've got to do it at 3 years old, because by the time it's five, it'll all be gone because the cask will have taken over and you'll just be getting, you know, that 60, 70% of wood influence that accounts for so much of a good whiskey's flavor. So terroir is a construct. It's terroir. Buy my whiskey at 3 years old in a 50 CL bottle for 70 or 80 pounds, please. Thank you very much. You know, it's great. It's like the emperor's new clothes. But no one seems to want to call it, but I'm prepared to call it, you know, and some of these other things too. Oh, and by the way, I should say, James, the whiskies may well be very nice. So I'm not criticizing the whiskies. I've tasted lovely young whiskies, but let's not have the terroir thing. And please don't charge people so much money for this stuff. You know, it's crazy.
You also talk about some of the mythology around where the barrels are located and the influence that has on the characteristics of the whiskey as it matures. And there's a great quote in your book about, you know, it's nice to think that your whiskey might have rested for years in an old cobweb-filled Dunnage warehouse with salt water and seaweed crashing against the stone walls during wild Hebridean storms. But the reality is that the size and the scale of the industry rarely allows for that. This sort of marketing is still alive and well, though. So why do you think it's so persistent?
So when I started working on single malts, and stuff that had been put out in the past about what was called at the time the classic malts, and particular the island, the Hebridean malts in that collection, was all about that scene that I painted. In fact, sometimes you read it and you might think the barrels were actually outside the warehouse, not inside. You know, it's like it's nuts, you know. And also in larger companies, out in the Hebrides, it's just impossible to store all your whiskey there. I mean, Islay now, to my mind, has been somewhat scarred by a couple of companies building a lot of warehouses, and they're not pretty. If all the whiskey distilleries on Islay were to build sufficient warehouses to store all their whiskey, the island would be violated. It would be horrible. And companies have already always sent either casks back to be matured on the mainland, or sometimes it's...
Talisker's a good example. Talisker's
a very good example. Or they send tankers back and fill casks on the mainland and then store them there. So I think that sort of Hebridean romance thing, just, you know, it's just, come on, be serious. But there is an important point here, because most of for example, Diageo's whiskies are now stored on two sites which are within a mile or so of the sea. But they happen to be on the mainland, not in the Hebrides. The whole of Scotland is a maritime climate. The whole of Scotland is a maritime climate. And that climate definitely has a profound influence on the way that whiskey matures, which is, for example, totally different in Scotland than it is in Kentucky, which has a very different climate, you know, all year round. So I'm not denying the maritime influence on maturation. I'm just trying to make it real, because you have to understand that for the most part, it's not happening on a wee island in the Hebrides. It's happening somewhere on the mainland, but there's still a profound maritime influence on that process. People are suckered in by romance, and it's the same with the terroir thing. It's romance, you know? I remember, okay, we'll go back. We ran a training program, which we put a lot of time and effort into for both people inside the Diageo business, and we also invited writers and commentators along as well. We called it the Malt Advocates Course. And it would be a week, or sometimes we do it in sort of 2 or 3 days. And it was, look, this is how it is about making whiskey, right? With some of the best and most accomplished scientists, if you will, technical experts, blenders, maturation, whole thing, really intense program. And I remember the first time we got journalists along, we had Michael Jackson, late Michael Jackson, who I knew pretty well, and I had a very good relationship with Michael. And we had the first morning, right, where, which was just the sort of basics of what we're going to talk about, whiskey, you need to know this, you need to know that. And Michael came out there and he said, "This is great, but you're taking all the romance out." And it was like, well, Michael, this is how it is. This is the fact of the matter, you know. And I prefer facts to romance. And I think people, if they want to invest in the romance, that's fine. But I think they need to understand the facts too. And that's what I try and do in the book.
You mentioned that whiskey had a bit of an inferiority complex when, you know, in comparison to wine, and that perhaps that was how the whole terroir kind of story has also been dreamed up a bit.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's quite interesting, because if you go back to the 19th century remember, you're talking about the demon drink. In fact, you're talking about the demon drink until the 1930s, 1940s even, when the temperance movement was still so strong, not just in the UK, but in Australia, in the United States, New Zealand, you know, Canada, very, very strong temperance movements. And the Walkers, for example, didn't really like to call themselves whiskey blenders or stuff like that. So they wine merchant was a phrase they would preferred to use, or wine and spirit merchant. And I think there was a sort of respectability about wine that whiskey was not felt to have. And I think there's a bit of and it's something I'm actually going to write about at more length, because I think there is this sort of sense of inferiority that's run through whiskey, and it's still there today. Somehow it's not quite as good as wine. It's not like the sort of public school educated wine chaps in St. James with the pink trousers and all that sort of nonsense. And I look at the way that some brands have covered themselves with wine terminology. There was an example of a single malt whiskey that was released, I think, earlier this year, which was a Grand Cru something or other. And you looked at the box and it was like, hang on, is this whiskey or what is this? And
of course, the only reason they called it Grand Cru is because they couldn't call it. Actually, you know, they couldn't actually name what the barrels had.
The wine cask. They, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think all of that, suddenly everything becomes very muddled and confused. And the distinctiveness of what Scotch whiskey should be about gets eroded. And I think that's very dangerous, actually, for the category. I think there are a number of things that are eroding the distinctiveness of Scotch at the moment, which some people seem to be willy-nilly running headfirst into. And I think in the long term, it's not actually good for the category. Scotch is about Scotch. So I think there's too much wine stuff being used. And I think there are other things where, you know, that are equally, I think, confusing in terms of what it is that consumers are being offered.
You talk about the rise of the social media expert or the blogger. Is this something that you've railed against on Kind of Gathering?
Well, if you talk to some people, they'll say that I might have been responsible for this because we, you know, we nurtured a lot of people in Diageo because we could see how important social media was going to be. We tried to train them, educate them, get them to understand not just brands that I worked on in Diageo, but Scotch more generally. And I think those people have been hugely powerful and are hugely influential and are a source of good in the industry, you know. But at the same time, everyone will know that the world of social media is full of very shouty people. And in the world of whiskey in particular, unfortunately, it seems to be full of very shouty men. And there's a certain sort of type of social media discourse, which I think is not great for whiskey. It's sort of bullying. You know, I mean, I play guitars, right? And I sometimes look at guitar forums, although increasingly not very often. And it's the classic thing where someone puts a post on a forum saying, oh, I've a newbie, as they would like to call it. I think that's an old-fashioned phrase now. But, you know, a new guy goes to a forum and said, oh, I've just bought a Mexican Fender Stratocaster, and I'm really happy. I'm so delighted with this. What do you guys think about it? And you know, immediately, 1,000 people around the world tell this guy he's an absolute idiot. And what's he talking about? You know, and all the rest of it. And it's sad that it's the same in whiskey. You know, there's just this sort of bullying herd mentality of some idea of a correctness here that has to be imposed on everyone. And of course, many of the people that are doing the shouty stuff don't really know what they're talking about, you know.
I've seen that exact thing with, you know, when someone's posted a picture of a Johnny Walker, you know,
classic.
Johnny Walker.
I wouldn't clean my car windscreen with it. It's one of the classics that you get, yeah. Live and let live. And if people don't realise that every new person that buys a bottle of Johnny Walker Red Label and comes into the Scotch whisky category is helping those people enjoy their single malts, because the two are intrinsically linked together. And if you didn't have those new people coming in, some start with Johnny Walker and end up with Grand Cru, this and that. Others just drink Johnny Walker all their lives. But brands like Johnny Walker are the foot soldiers. Red Label, Grant Standfast, Teachers. These are the foot soldiers in the world of Scotch whisky. And if we didn't have those, we certainly wouldn't have the rest of the stuff that people like to mouth off about so much, you know?
And you make the point as well, actually, I think that really it's because of the success of blends that, you know, single malts have become of such a greater quality than they once were.
Absolutely. And I think it's a point that's not really like fully understood. Again, I think there's this romantic idea that there's a distillery somewhere with a distillery manager who's normally... The men always like to perceive of distillery managers as being old bearded men in tweed jackets, whereas, of course, in reality now, they're just more than likely to be a young woman with tattoos and all the rest of it. But they've got this idea of, you know, it's the old man making the whiskey, and he sort of chooses what he wants to make, and he makes it in his own style and blah, blah, blah. That's not the case. You know, if you're a distillery manager, you make the sort of whiskey that you know your customer wants, or if you're owned by a larger business, as most distilleries are, you make the sort of whiskey that you're told to make because your blenders know exactly what whiskey they need either to make their blended scotches or to blend their single malts, because all single malts are blends of different casks. There's a recipe. Talisker 10-year-old, there is a recipe for Talisker 10-year-old. We're going to have so much of that sort of cask, so much of this, so much of that. Bingo, Talisker 10-year-old. So this idea, you know, that people just make what they want and it's all great, you know, isn't going to happen. And the blenders, over the past 100 years or so, have actually pulled the quality of single malt whiskey up by its bootstrings, you know, from sometimes, frankly, not being very good at all to being what it is now, where, you know, so many of the single malts that are produced all over Scotland are of such, these, again, going back to what I said earlier, these core expressions, you know, the 8, the 10, the 12-year-old whiskies, Glenlivet, Glenfiddich, you know, I mean, how do they do it? How do they make this stuff so good every time? absolutely brilliant. And that's down to someone sitting in a white coat in a room somewhere in the central belt of Scotland going, this is what we're going to make. This is the cask we're going to put it into. This is where it's going to be. And when it comes out, it's going to be absolutely great.
On a related topic, the rise of the cask finish is something that's also explored with some really interesting opinions in the book. Where do you stand on cask finishing personally?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. As you say, one of the things I did in the book was talk to some of my friends who I've got to know very well over the past sort of 20, 30 years and ask, because it's going to be boring listening to my opinion all the time. So I wanted to get some other opinions in the book as well. And it was interesting talking about cask finishing, I think, because there was an almost absolute consensus amongst people that the cask finishes that really kicked off the whole thing, from Balvenie, Portwood, Doublewood, Glenmorangie, of course, as well, you know, were really sort of first-class things. I think the cask finishes that were done for the classic malts, which were launched in the mid-90s, 96 or something, were also very good. I mean, things like the Lagavulin PX, Distiller's Edition, just delightful whiskies. But, you know, I think one of the problems with cask finishing is that it's become a quick way to innovate. And it's not really innovating at all. But particularly if you're a single brand and you want to fill up some of that shelf space that you can't just occupy by your 10-year-old or 12-year-old offering. So what are you going to do? Let's do some cask finishes and get some more facings, you know, more facings in duty-free, as it was so important before the pandemic. More facings in the retailer's store, in the supermarket, whatever it might be. Oh, and if we do a cask finish, we don't need to put an age on it because the cask finish will cover up maybe the fact that whiskey's not quite old enough to bottle. So I think, you know, cask finishing has become a way of feeding this appetite for lots of new releases at the cost sometimes of quality. And if you look at the book, you'll see that almost everyone I spoke to said exactly the same thing. So this isn't just me spouting off. It's people like Charlie McLean and Dave Broom, so on and so forth.
I think we've just been released an allocation of the Guinness cask finished Lagavulin, which I think you expressed an unfavourable opinion of in the book.
Well, let's just say, had I have been still in a position to influence things, I probably would not have done that. I'll just leave it at that, I think.
Okay, we'll move on. What do you think of, you know, some of the most exciting developments in the industry over recent years?
Well, I think, although it may have sounded that I'm giving them a hard time, I think the fact that we've got so many new distilleries is absolutely terrific. And if you'd have asked anyone in the industry when I joined in 1990 to describe what the world of whiskey would look like in 2020 or 2021, forget the pandemic, let's pretend that just didn't happen, right? No one would have painted you a picture that was anything like the scene that we have now. Not just in Scotland, of course, but in England, in Ireland, in all over Europe, in Australia, in New Zealand, the United States. I mean, it's just astonishing that so many people have come into distilling, many of whom, you know, have got really great ideas and they are really determined to make great whiskey. Of course, not everyone's going to last. I mean, it's just impossible that these people will all stick around and not all of them can be bought up by a big corporate, which is probably what some of them are sort of hoping for. You know, it's a classic sort of business thing. But I think the energy and the vitality and the excitement that's just brought into the category as a whole is quite remarkable. And I read somewhere just last week or the week before last a report being published, and I don't know by whom, so I mean it could be nonsense, but it was predicting that sales of whiskey around the world, so this isn't Scotch, global sales of whiskey around the world would double in the next decade. I mean, that is how you have to ask yourself, how could something that was considered to be a demon drink, you know, a home breaker, a home destroyer, how could something like that suddenly have become this luxury product, as everyone likes to call it, an investment vehicle for, you know, for speculators and collectors, the world's just been, whiskey has been transformed. And there's too much, I think, to pick out any one thing that's exciting, because I think that's just exciting enough.
I must say, you certainly challenge the perception that I had of the history of Japanese whiskey. You've written a column on that fairly recently as well that I imagine would have been quite controversial in Japan.
I'm not sure if it's controversial. Again, I'm just saying things as they are. And it's back to whether you want to believe the romance or whether you want to, you know, look at things in sort of the cold light of day. And I think, you know, a couple of things. First off, some of the Japanese whiskies that are available today are of the most astonishing quality. You know, some of them just absolutely brilliant. And I think it's a great shame that the sort of reputation of Japanese whiskey has been somewhat besmirched by practices that had gone on for a long time and were not fully declared in terms of using non-Japanese whiskies in Japanese blends in particular. And that was something that was really going on in plain sight, actually, which is one of the things I mentioned in the column that you referred to. But I think the thing is that Japanese producers, you know, have all been wedded to this story about this man called Takatsura, who came to Scotland in the early 1920s, learnt how to make whiskey sort of at the feet of the masters. He went to Campbelltown and was in Hazelburn, where Whitehorse Distillers had the first lab studying science of whiskey. He met a Scottish woman, fell in love, and they eventually went back to Japan, got married. You know, and it's a lovely story, and it's, as I say in the book, told through tartan-tinted spectacles, you know, because the marriage between Takatsura and his wife Rita, I think, is used by the Japanese distillers as being sort of symbolic as this long-standing alliance between Scotland and Japan, and it doesn't talk about, that story doesn't talk about the amount of bulk malt whiskey that was being exported to Japan in the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s. Which is being used deliberately by some Japanese producers to enhance the reputation of their domestic product, both in the Japanese market and also increasingly internationally. That story is not told. It's just the romantic story. Well, the fact of the matter is that once the Scottish distillers who'd hosted Takatsura realized that it was the ambition of these people in Japan to make Scotch whiskey, they were outraged. They were absolutely outraged, and tried to shut the stable door very much after the horse had bolted. And, you know, the way they looked on it was that it was industrial espionage, you know, which of course, is not the way the story is told. But there are two ways of telling every story. And in the book and in the article I've written, because I refer to it there as well, I'm just suggesting that, you know, things are not necessarily as people would like you to believe them, that's all. Which is something that runs through the whole book. You know, it's just get real about some of these things.
Glassware is another thing that you pay attention to. Tell me about, you know, your thoughts on glassware that you've explored in the book.
Well, I'm actually devastated on the subject of glassware at the moment, because in the book I refer to the fact that I have a favourite glass that I bought in a second-hand shop somewhere years ago, and it's an old tumbler, and it's certainly not Riedel glass. It's probably the cheapest glass you could imagine, and it actually shattered on Sunday night spontaneously, as glasses sometimes do. Exploded. So I've now got to go and trawl second-hand shops to try and find a replacement that's warm in the hand, as I like to say, and warm in the measure as well. I mean, I think, you know, I've spent enough time assessing whiskies professionally to know that when you do that, you need to use a proper glass. And I think the ISO standard Capita glass is what people should use for that. I can't stand
which one's that? Sorry, that's
The ISO, so, little sherry. Well, you might call it a sherry Capita.
Like it's sort of a tulip,
yeah,
shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's gotcha. You go into any blender's room today. When go into any blender's room 100 years ago, that's what people use to assess whiskies. You know, and sometimes they use a blue one, so you can't see the color. You're just actually focusing exactly on what's the liquid that's in the glass. But, you know, you can't drink out of these things. They're rubbish to drink from, really. Obviously, the Glencairn glass, to an extent, sort of does a bit of both. So it allows you to do a bit of the forensic assessment. It's a bit easier to drink from. But you know, I'm in the same school as Dave Broome, who I quote in my book here when I said, what sort of glass is best for drinking? And Dave just said, drinking? Any glass, you know? And people just make too much fuss about it. And again, people are trying to make money out of having the best whiskey glass for this, best whiskey glass for that. But, and as someone else I spoke to for the book said, you know, if there's one subject that's going to provoke almost violence amongst whiskey enthusiasts, it's the subject of glassware, which is crazy, really.
Well, Nick, I think I've kept you for about an hour. Is there anything else that you think we should cover before we wrap up?
Two things, actually, I would like to say. Is that when I first spoke to Sukhinder about the book, he was very clear that he would like it to celebrate people who've been really important in terms of his business over the past 25 or 30 years. And I certainly wanted to do that as well. So, excuse me, there is a chapter on whiskey people, and it sort of goes way back, but also talks about those people who really have had a huge impact, you know, over the past 20, 30, 40 years. People like Jack and Wallace Milroy, whose name is remembered because of the shop still in London, Soho. But I think maybe Jack and Wallace themselves are a bit forgotten, and yet they were as influential in the rise of single malts as the Grants family at William Grants, who launched Glenfiddich. You know, producers were never going to make this successful unless there were retailers who wanted to make it successful as well. So both of those people, the sort of groups of people and others, are celebrated in the book. And the other thing I did, which I was really keen to do, and actually it was one of the most interesting parts of the book, was sort of look at the literature of whiskey as well, which is extensive. And, you know, of recent years, perhaps has not been too great because a lot of the books are all sort of the same. But I go back and look at the great whiskey books of the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s, 70s. And I found it really enjoyable to actually go back and reread all of these things I've got up here, and was reminded at how insightful some of these early writers were, and how important their thinking was actually for the way that people still think today. So that was just one of the things that I really particularly enjoyed.
And yeah, you also paid particular tribute to a couple of blenders or distillers, so David Stewart and Jim Beveridge, who you characterise them as true experts in the craft.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've obviously worked a lot with Jim over the years on many projects, and I've got just huge respect for not just for what he does in terms of the liquids that he's produced, but also the way he thinks. I mean, Jim is the most remarkable cerebral person. And, you know, you have to watch Jim Beveridge do a mind map in front of you to really understand how he thinks. And it's quite astonishing, particularly when you then see that applied to blending whiskies. It's remarkable. David Stewart, I've been lucky enough to spend time with, and he's just such an understated, elegant man who takes his craft very lightly. But, you know, all of the people in the book talked about David's influence, particularly on the early cask finishing at Balvenie, and just how important that was. And the thing about these two guys is that they're not shouty. You don't see them all over the place. They're not on social media. They're just there doing their work and producing great whiskies, you know.
And we need more of that. Well, Nick, thanks so much for your time and congratulations on the books. I haven't read the Johnny Walker one, but I'm well on the way to finishing the Everything You Need to Know. So, yeah, congratulations on it. I'll be recommending that my listeners get hold of a copy.
Thank you very much, James, and thank you for talking to me. It's been great. Good fun.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people that this is a show worth listening to. or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.